The state legislature already ended its regular session, but more work remains on funding for protecting Arizona's children. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Dana Namark of Children's Action Alliance about what an upcoming special session should include and how important child care vouchers could be. Also, the Phoenix City Council could face a contentious session this afternoon as it deals with where labor unions fit into balancing the city's budget. Dustin Gardner of the Arizona Republic will give us an update. Plus, you should keep paying close attention behind the wheel. The Department of Public Safety is increasing efforts to crack down on distracted driving. Bart Graves of DPS will explain. Extreme high temperatures will arrive in the valley soon. The National Weather Service and local health agencies are teaming up to prepare us. We'll talk about the heat initiative. And Valley rocker Roger Klein and his band, The Peacemakers, are out with a new CD. We'll hear some tracks and talk about his inspirations. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the Phoenix City Council could face a contentious session this afternoon as it deals with where labor unions fit into balancing the city's budget. Dustin Gardner of the Arizona Republic will give us an update. Plus, you should keep paying close attention behind the wheel. The Department of Public Safety is increasing efforts to crack down on distracted driving. Bart Graves of DPS will explain. Extreme high temperatures will arrive in the valley very soon. The National Weather Service and local health agencies are teaming up to prepare us. We'll talk about the new heat initiative. And Valley rocker Roger Klein and his band, The Peacemakers, are out with a new CD. We'll hear some tracks and talk with Roger. We start today's program with a look at what could or should be next in funding for protecting Arizona's vulnerable children. Dana Namark is president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance and joins me now. Dana, good morning.
Good morning.
Before we get into some specifics, I do want to ask you when you anticipate the special session on child protection taking place. What have you heard?
Well, I have a guess that it will either be right before or right after Memorial Day. The only thing we know for sure is that it will be before July 1 because that's the beginning of the fiscal year, and I know the governor wants to have the new agency officially up and running before then.
Considering this is an issue that's been talked about, obviously not just for months but for years, is this something... Can we measure how long we think the session is going to be? Typically, special sessions, we like those to be short and sweet. Is it possible this one would be less than a week?
It is. As you know, with the legislature, anything is possible. I think that there will be a lot of conversation among legislators and with community groups, hopefully beginning next week, leading up to special session. So it would be ideal if we could get a lot of that discussion and attack on the issues done before that, and that the special session would then be short and sweet.
Dana, what are child care vouchers and why are they a good idea?
Child care vouchers are something we've had for a very long time that actually became expanded under a Ronald Reagan initiative across the country. And the idea of a child care voucher is to help working families who earn low incomes find safe and affordable child care. And it's a win-win-win because it certainly helps those parents. It is good for children to have safe and nurturing places while their parents are at work, and it helps them learn and develop their skills for school. And it's good for business and for our economy and for our workforce because it gives workers much more stability and reliability that we know our businesses and our employers need. The other win that has become very apparent is that when we have child care vouchers, it does help prevent child neglect. And when we don't have those vouchers and when they're frozen, which has been the case since 2009, we see huge increases in reports of child neglect. And that's certainly not the only reason, but it's a contributing factor. So now is a very good time to go back and rebuild those child care vouchers to help turn those trends around in reports to CPS.
What have you heard from lawmakers on their opinion about child care vouchers?
You know, it's varied. There's a lot of interest, and in those final days of the regular legislative session when they were voting on the budget, there was a lot of intense debate and discussion with very varied opinions among lawmakers. And what we want to do is help them really focus on the results and the consequences. And if our goal is to reduce abuse and neglect, to get the workload manageable for CPS, to help our economy and our businesses, then child care vouchers are an excellent strategy to do that.
Dana, when we think of all the factors, how much attention should the prevention of child abuse and neglect get in the upcoming special session?
Well, it should get substantial attention, and certainly there are so many problems and issues related to how we've been administering child protective services. There are many organizational issues that need attention. But if we ignore prevention and early intervention, we'll be making a big mistake, because we will be right back into some other crisis, maybe not this exact crisis, but some other crisis next year or the year after. Early intervention is absolutely the key to helping families be stronger and helping kids be safer.
So why doesn't prevention of neglect and abuse get more attention? Not to say people don't talk about it, but is it one of those things that is almost an unmeasurable until we know that something has happened to a child? The prevention part of it is sort of in that ether somewhere?
That's right. Prevention is often hard to measure, not always, and we do have ways to measure it, but it's harder to measure. And it is one of those things where the benefits are off in the future. And so in our political system and our budgeting system that's year to year, it's sometimes hard to focus on something where the benefits are in the future. But certainly, you know, over many years, as you have pointed out, we've seen the devastating impact when we don't focus on prevention. So I am hopeful that it will get some attention, and the special session will not be the end. We need to make sure we keep paying attention to CPS and to prevention going forward into this election season and next year's legislative session as well.
Dana, finally, your thoughts on the job Charles Flanagan is doing so far, and your thoughts about Clarence Carter still holding a job.
Well, I think Charles Flanagan is doing an excellent job in very difficult circumstances. He has learned a tremendous amount in a short amount of time about child abuse and neglect, which is not in his background. I think he's a very strong leader and strong at setting clear goals and getting the tools and the support for his staff that are needed to move toward those goals. He can't do it alone, so it will be key for him to have a management team to do that with him. It's very disturbing to me that Clarence Carter remains there, but our time and energy is really focused on going forward and what we can do to make sure that children are protected from abuse and neglect and have safe and permanent and loving homes going forward.
Dana Namark, President and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. Dana, thanks.
Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Phoenix City Council is expected to experience some contentiousness this afternoon, as possible pay and benefit cuts should bring out a number of unhappy union members. The city's negotiating new labor agreements at the same time it's trying to figure out how to erase a nearly $38 million deficit. Dustin Gardner covers all things Phoenix government for the Arizona Republic and joins me now. Hi, Dustin.
Hey, Steve.
So what union groups are we talking about? Why has the situation become what I'm calling so contentious?
So we have, there's five union groups at City Hall with collective bargaining rights, and two of those five groups have refused to accept the city's final offer on their upcoming contracts. And those two groups are the police officers and AFSCME 2384, which represents skilled laborers like the mechanics and electricians. And those two groups are holding out for a raise, and it looks like it's heading to the point where they'll be an unresolvable impasse with city management, and so city council members would have to impose a contract.
What are council members telling you? Obviously, they have different opinions about a lot of different topics. So what are they saying?
I think a lot of the council members are saying that they don't want it to come to them, because if it comes to them, it could be a potentially politically divisive fight. There's strong ideological differences on the council over this issue. We have, you know, a group of pretty labor-friendly council members who are sort of hoping, I think, that the unions will accept the city's best offer, realizing there is a budget deficit. And then we have a faction of conservative council members who say the city's best offer is not acceptable because it also includes pay raises and bonuses for many of the union members.
So overall, I'm coming back to the word contentious. How contentious is this? And is this a matter, is this like a perfect storm situation, Dustin, where we're in a real struggle, the combination of the budget deficit and the timing of these union negotiations? Are people down there optimistic that this will turn out okay or not?
Yeah, that's a perfect storm is a good description. That's how the city's labor administrator described it to me. It's, you know, this is unprecedented to have these two union groups this far in the process, unwilling to accept agreements. The last time that one of the city's unions got this far without accepting an agreement was in the early 1980s. So I don't think anyone is taking anything for granted. There's a lot of people concerned that this is going to continue and the council members are going to have to impose some sort of deal that's going to leave hundreds of workers, thousands of workers unhappy.
As I mentioned, the city has a nearly $38 million deficit. How did this happen? And any chance that the controversial to some food tax reappears?
So the deficit, the deficit is a result of several factors kind of coming together at once. One of the biggest is perhaps the city's overly optimistic revenue projections in the past. They overshot their projections by about $25, $30 million for the current fiscal year. Mm. I mean, or they undershot. So that's been a major contributor. And then we also have a lot of rising employee costs, pensions, health care have really been skyrocketing the last couple of years. So those factors are coming together and it's creating a pretty tight situation. But the food tax, as far as I understand it, is completely off the table. The council had an opportunity to consider bringing that back. As many listeners might know, they voted to repeal half of that tax early last year, and that cost the city about $33 million in revenue. Mm. But I guess because of the politics, there's some pretty sensitive politics surrounding that. The council has been completely unwilling to revisit that.
What are some of the options that City Manager Ed Zuercher is considering, and are any considered to be dramatic, draconian, whatever word we want to use?
So he's looking at three areas to balance this budget. He's looking at employee cuts. The cuts that he's proposed would save about $16 million. He's also looking at revenue and tax and fee increases. And those increases he's proposed would bring about $12 million. And then he's also talked about service cuts. In his initial trial budget, he outlined some $29 million in service cuts to help balance the deficit. But it's important to keep in mind that if employees take those cuts and tax and fee revenues are increased by that roughly $12 million, that would seriously limit the amount of service cuts that would be needed to probably, I was doing the math last night, it looks about potentially $1 million to $2 million in only cuts that would be needed.
And is this an incremental step, Dustin? Are there reasons to believe that they won't be so optimistic in projections going forward, or is it possible the next time the budget comes up, we could be in the same situation?
I think a lot of council members are seeing this as a moment to sort of fix the structural problems that have led to some of Phoenix's budget problems in recent years. They're wanting to get union contracts that clearly outline the benefits and, you know, expenses. They're wanting to get new revenue sources that are going to be secure and stable. And perhaps most importantly, they're wanting to make sure the city is having realistic projections and not forming a budget that's going to, you know, based on revenue forecasts, there are double what might be realized.
And finally, what are council members or others telling you about what they think of Ed Zuercher so far?
I think Ed Zuercher is being, I guess, very well received at this point. He's popular among employees, popular among council members. I think a common perception is that he's sort of cleaning up the mess that he inherited. He did not take the city's helm until late last October. He wasn't in the job permanently until February. And so he was not the person that crafted this previous budget. That was former city manager David Cavazos. And I reached out to David Cavazos to get his take on some of these criticisms, and he's uninterested in commenting.
I guess we shouldn't be totally surprised by that. Dustin Gardner covers Phoenix government for the Arizona Republic. Dustin, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Still to come on here, and now DPS is watching you on the roads to make sure you're not distracted, so don't look at their cars when you drive by. Mark Graves tells us what's going on. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Phoenix, where patient-empowered care means your treatment team meets with you at one time, in one room, for every appointment, to answer your questions. CancerCenter.com.
What is your mic?
There's technical problems there. Yep.
You'll fire the other underwriter.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The recent legislative session included more efforts to put a clamp on distracted driving, especially by teenage drivers who are new behind the wheel. But despite a renewed push for legislation, there wasn't any progress. But the State Department of Public Safety is still focused on you, especially if you're not focused on the road in front of you, and instead are looking at your phone or rubbernecking to check out an accident. Bart Graves, DPS PIO, joins me in studio with more details. Bart, good morning.
Morning.
So how does DPS define distracted driving?
Well, basically, any behavior that takes your focus off the wheel, off of the road,
we believe is distracted driving.
So anything. So the focus on texting, is that not something that DPS focuses on?
Well, we set out this campaign. The director, Robert Halliday of DPS, set out this campaign with the Highway Patrol not to solely emphasize texting and cell phone use, which is a factor in distracted driving-related crashes, but to any and all behavior that causes crashes to begin with. We put out a press release after the really intensive week-long focus, although we continue to educate people about the hazards of distracted driving, and Highway Patrol does, that the number one cause of distracted driving-related crashes are people that slow down. And I've even seen this stop on the freeway to see a crash by the side of the road. I can't tell you how many times we have responded to serious injury and fatal crashes caused not by the original crash that people are slowing to see, but the resulting crashes in the back of the line where people are going too fast and suddenly traffic stops and they're distracted and they slam into.
Well, considering human nature, how do you get people to stop doing that? I mean, we've all heard about rubbernecking for forever.
Well, you know, we... Sometimes part of this, what we've done with this particular campaign is we have, we'll use officers in marked and unmarked vehicles to look at driver behavior. When you have a, we've done a very good job lately, the last couple of years, with our partners at ADOT, the Traffic Incident Management System, when we have injury crashes, to get them off the road as fast as possible, get them to the shoulder, and then we'll monitor drivers' behaviors as they drive by. If they're slowing down to look, a lot of people literally stop and look, we'll cite them. That is a permanent lesson to them to stop doing that, because that causes a lot of problems for everybody.
Now, I've heard some public service announcements recently. Move over AZ, I think, is how it's phrased.
Right.
Now, that's about when we see a fire truck, when we see a police car, we should... There is something about slowing down, though, right? As long as you're not slowing down to look. It's slowing down for safety.
Well, once again, this is about keeping your main focus on driving. If you see there's... And by the way, the law was expanded, I believe, in 2011 to cover not just emergency vehicles, but disabled motorists by the side of the road, tow truck drivers, ADOT workers, and so forth. And so you see that ahead. You see... something going on by the roadway, certainly, you know, a crash, and we're attending to it as part of that, is to, as soon as it's safe to do so, change lanes and give it wide berth. That's two different things.
Does DPS have an official policy on texting while driving? Is this renewed push related to the fact that Arizona is one of a few states, just a handful of states, that doesn't have specific laws related to texting while driving?
I don't believe that was the impetus. I believe the director is very passionate about this because of the high number of crashes. Just in the sample period for this program, we sampled crashes from November 1st to April 1st, November 1st, 2013 to April 1st, 2014, 10,166 crashes across the state. That's just in a less than 6 months period. That shows you what we're up against. And that's something that's we've been dealing with forever. So if we can lower that number, take the distracted drivers, get them educated, and this really is an educational campaign more than it is an enforcement campaign, to get them to realize how serious this driving behavior is and to correct their ways, then we can probably reduce that number of crashes, fatal crashes, serious injury crashes.
One thing I've always wondered about, forgive my skepticism for just a second part, the idea that people who need to get this message are less likely to be paying attention to it. I'm wondering, have you worked with ADOT about having more messages up, for example, so people are thinking about it more consciously?
We did. During that peak week of enforcement, April 10th through April 15th, if you drove anywhere across the state, and we'd have those overhead digital signs, which are wonderful, and you see them in Flagstaff, you see them in Kingman, you see them coming into Parker, you see them wherever you're going. And that helped us tremendously. ADOT, our partners, flashed our slogan, "Highways don't kill, but distracted drivers will." That got that got drivers to look up and say, and then look around to see if one of our units is close by. And maybe they paid more attention to their driving during those times.
Anything to indicate the issue's a bigger deal around the valley, where it's more congested, or is the problem just everywhere?
Well, the problem is everywhere, but we see it more often here in the metro freeway system. It is a major problem when it comes to especially peak rush hour periods, where people are not paying attention, going too fast for conditions, distracted. And let me just go through distracted driving. There's, certainly cell phone use was the number two cause for distracted driving related crashes, behind slowing down to look at crashes. The third major cause for distracted driving is distractions inside the vehicle. So someone's screwing around with a radio, or they're reaching down to grab a bottle of water that fell on the floor, or they're maybe disciplining their kids or something, and then suddenly they look up, the car stopped in front of them, bam. That's how those kind of things happen.
Well, the radio thing is disturbing because especially our listeners probably shouldn't ever leave KJZZ. They should just stay there and not
as a governmental agency, I cannot endorse that, but it's certainly a good idea.
Distracted drivers more likely to come in a certain age group? Because I know, again, we mentioned at the Capitol, there was more concern about new drivers.
You know, we find younger folks are more likely to be texting and to be distracted on the phone, more texting than actually talking on the cell phone. But you have to realize, let's take talking on the cell phone, for instance, that your concentration is diverted. You're not really totally focused on driving and road conditions around you. You have part of your attention to the conversation. So what we've seen is people slow down while they're talking. They're not keeping up with the speeds on the highway. And I've actually seen someone getting on a freeway and an on-ramp, and, you have to move quickly and get in your lane, and traffic is moving to get on the freeway, and then they're yielding for you. There's a big backup on this on-ramp I was getting on. I couldn't figure out and then I got around slowing traffic, and it was a younger woman texting, and her car literally was moving 15 miles per hour to get onto the freeway. Now, that's an extreme case, but it shows what we're up against.
Final 30 seconds or so, Bart. How is DPS cracking down? Even if there was the renewed push and now it's still sort of out there, because I'm wondering if this is a situation where you hear about secondary violations, is this going to be something where they can be cited for, it's not, okay, we got you for something else and we saw you were distracted? You know what I mean? In the sense, we have got the seatbelt violation, which is a secondary violation.
Right. Well, distracted driving, like I say, this is an educational campaign. So what we'll do is we see evidence that people are distracted, that people are doing things behind the wheel, and they are not really totally focused on the task of driving. We will pull them over. We'll give them information. We'll give them a handout and say, we are very concerned about distracted drivers, and you could have caused a collision just now. We're not going to cite you, but we're going to, this is a teachable moment, is what we call it, and here's what you should not do when you're on the freeway going 65 miles per hour, that kind of thing.
Bart Graves, Department of Public Safety. Bart, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona Town Hall is holding its 104th gathering in Tucson. The three-day series of meetings is looking into Arizona's vulnerable populations. The town hall wraps up today at noon. Scott Rhodes, Town Hall Chair, explains what the purpose of the event is and its goals.
The issues are as big as the state, and the participants come from all over the state. There are typically between 110 and 150 participants at each town hall. There are two a year, and there have been for over 50 years. Town Hall's never been shy about taking on the hardest issues facing our state. And we do it always with the same objective, which is to reach consensus on our ideas about those hard issues and a path forward towards solving them. We don't take votes. We don't focus on what's dividing us. We focus on what we have in common.
Scott, so many people focus on the politics of the world we're in and how different people seem to be, at least when it comes to elected officials. When it comes to a group like Arizona Town Hall, are there passionate arguments? Are people agreeing to disagree? Are people looking for, as you talk about, consensus? How hard is it to get to that consensus?
You know, that's the amazing part about this, and I've been to many town halls and been involved in the organization for many years. Every time I wonder, will it happen again? And every time it does. And by it, I mean a collaboration and a gathering of intelligent, articulate, knowledgeable people from around the state, but who are very diverse and who have different points of view and who might think of politics from their point of view. And if we were voting, they might be voting for different sides on every issue. And yet in this setting, which is very non-threatening, and it's focused on solving problems, not identifying differences, those people come together and they talk to each other with respect. They seek to understand each other's points of view and then to, of course, articulate their own. It can be hard to reach a consensus, but they work through it because they never give up on the concept that it is possible to do public policy in a different way that's not divisive, and to actually come up with possible answers to these difficult issues by working together. And at each town hall, it happens again and again.
When a consensus comes out of a town hall, Scott, what is next? What is the next step? Who hears about it?
There is a report that's developed, and there again, we're unique in the United States. It's 2.5 days of discussion while a report is being created. And at the end of the plenary session on the last morning, we have a final report. And that I'm not aware of any other organization in the United States that's able to bring together so many people, discuss these hard issues, and actually develop a report before they're finished. Then that report goes to the legislature, but it also goes to all the universities, it goes to the schools, it goes to the libraries. But we do a summary report of it as well, which is smaller. And we send that to all of the members of Town Hall and many other individuals. And then Town Hall staff does a series of outreach programs throughout the state. And they go literally throughout the entire state and hold small Town Hall meetings in which they talk about what their recommendations were. We used to have a lot of legislators. Unfortunately, we don't have that many anymore who are interested in Town Hall, but many, many other leaders throughout the state, and including tribal leaders, follow what's happening at Town Hall and then try to incorporate the recommendations into their local actions.
The current Town Hall, the big topic, is Arizona's vulnerable populations. How is that arrived at? I wonder if you could even define for listeners what that means.
It's actually a very important and it's a frightening topic. Approximately 46% of Arizona households are vulnerable. Now, there is no governmental definition of vulnerable, but the definition that we've been using for the town hall is, in essence, a household or an individual who is not yet in crisis. In other words, who is not yet taking advantage of what we would call the safety net, but who is one event from being in crisis. And that event could be an economic event, such as losing a job, being cut back on hours, but it can also be something for example, falling into depression, or it can be a substance abuse issue that hasn't yet reached the point of being critical. It can be a transportation issue for an elderly person. There are many, many different ways in which a person can be vulnerable, but what they have in common is that they're one problem away from being subject to or eligible for the social welfare programs and the nonprofit organizations that exist. Statistically, it is shown that once a person goes into crisis, then the chances of success are less, and the cost to society increases dramatically. So the concept here is, first of all, to understand how many of our fellow citizens are so close to crisis, and they're not there yet. And the objective is to find ways to build resiliency for those people, get them access to information that might help them to avoid going into crisis, to get them access to individuals who might be able to help them. But anything that we can do so that they have the resiliency to, on their own or with the help of friends and neighbors and others, avoid going into crisis and build their way up so that they're no longer vulnerable.
How do you get people to act, and how exciting on one end and how frustrating is it on the other end if action is or is not taken?
It's the kind of problem that's so big that everybody has to have. Everybody has to take action. There's been a lot of discussion at this town hall about the assets, what people who are vulnerable bring to us. We should not forget that people who have been through a lot, who are going through difficult times, often have a point of view that is incredibly strong, incredibly resilient, with a determination to do well. And they contribute to our society. So one of the reasons we want to identify them and give life to what they are going through is to give them a voice as well. They have something to teach us.
Scott Rhodes of Jennings Strauss is also the chair of Arizona Town Hall going on right now in Tucson. Scott, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
KJZZ is supported by the CORE Institute, fellowship-trained orthopedic physicians helping patients keep life in motion. Offices valley-wide. TheCoreInstitute.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. The Valley forecast calling for sunshine and a high of 88 degrees today. Overnight lows should be in the mid-60s. More sunshine tomorrow with a high around 90. This weekend is the KJZZ Travel and Discovery Expo. Come see the world at the Phoenix Convention Center Saturday and Sunday. There'll be travel deals, show specials, and great prizes. The KJZZ Travel and Discovery Expo is this weekend. There's more details at travel.kjzz.org. Stay with us at noon for NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Sunny skies in Phoenix, and it's 78 degrees at 11:38.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The month of May starts tomorrow, and that means our extreme summer temperatures are very close. How hot is it going to be? How do those conditions affect our health? Beginning next month, a group including the National Weather Service, Arizona Department of Health Services, and Maricopa County Public Health will team up on a safety campaign focusing on all things heat. With me to talk about that effort are Jessica Nolte and Ken Waters, both of the National Weather Service's Phoenix office, and Matt Roach of the State Department of Health Services Climate and Health Program. He's the manager. Jessica, let me talk about this with you first. Talking about heat in the valley is a real common thing. We all do it, except for just a few months of the year. What's going to make this campaign different? What's going to stand out?
Well, this campaign brings together a lot of great resources, the safety messages from the Weather Service, the resource efforts from the different agencies and faith-based organizations to try and bring all this together to try and mitigate the impacts from heat for the public.
Now, HEAT is an acronym. Can you give us an idea of what it stands for?
Yeah, we picked a kind of a four-day theme based around the word heat. So H stands for hydrate, E stands for environment and weather, A stands for awareness, and T stands for take action.
Ken, I wonder, do people who have lived here a long time think they're somehow less vulnerable to this, and is that something the campaign has to focus on as well?
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. It's something we see all the time when we look at this, the statistics, where a lot of folks who succumb to the heat have actually been here for 30 or 40 years.
Matt, what are some of the things that people need to think about when they go into heat? And I want to talk about vulnerable population first. Who are the people who are most susceptible? I mean, it could hit any of us, I suppose, if you're not prepared.
So all heat-related deaths are preventable, but and everyone is affected. Some of the vulnerable populations that we see are our older adults, young kids, and outdoor workers, and people who exercise outdoors. And there are also people with chronic medical conditions and taking prescription medications. Could alter the body's ability to react to being okay in the heat. So the next step is, like, what can you do about it? So we basically mentioned three main messages. Stay cool. So go out during the coolest parts of the day. Use air conditioning. Stay hydrated. So remember to drink water before, during, and after going outside. And stay informed. So listen to the news or radio. Know when those heat alerts are going out during the hot times.
As I mentioned, the multiple groups coming together on this, Jessica, what about folks who come here during the summer for vacation and think, wow, this is actually kind of fun? How do we get the message out to those folks?
Well, we're, at least for this heat campaign, at least the first part of May, there's going to be a big social media push from our office, from the National Weather Service social media accounts, as well as the other folks and agencies that are joining in on this. But then when we get into the heart of the heat season, where we have periods of excessive heat warnings that go into effect, we'll just continue to broadcast these safety messages along with the, you know, kind of alerting the public to those periods of extreme heat.
Now, this is perhaps a silly question, but do the three of you all practice what you're preaching here? Are you all conscious of this going forward?
Yes.
Okay. Matt, I want to come back to you on this, because this idea of the extreme temperatures, how many people end up truly being affected by it? We hear about sometimes mountain rescues and people get stuck. Maybe they didn't have enough water. But over the course of, I don't know if you have annual statistics, but over the course of a year in the Valley, how many people are affected by this?
Definitely, I can talk on that. So on average, we see around 2,000 people go to the emergency room in Arizona from exposure to excessive natural heat. And on average, there are about 118 deaths a year. And a lot of these deaths we see are people between the ages of 20 and 54. And a large percentage of people we also see are dying indoors, and that's mostly our population over 65.
Wow, so people who perhaps can't afford air conditioning or decide they're not going to do that, is that something as well that comes up?
Yes, definitely.
Gosh, Ken, I'm wondering, does that frustrate you as a longtime meteorologist, this idea that you tell people it's going to be a certain condition outside and people decide, well, I can handle it?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's something we do have to deal with, not just with the heat, but with other hazards as well. The best we can do is to keep banging the drum and getting the word out.
Well, and Jessica, how much banging of the drum needs to be done? And actually, starting in May sounds like a great idea as well. Once people get caught up in the 100 degrees for 60 straight days, I suppose they're harder to find.
Yeah, well, we typically, at least over the last 30 years, the last normal period, experience our first 100-degree day in the first part of May, and actually falls on May 2nd. We have yet to see that here at Phoenix, but we know once we start to get into May, school starts getting out, Memorial Day holiday, and we start getting into the summer, that's when we start to see those periods of heat.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, going forward, is there something, you mentioned the social media component, is there going to be some sort of interactive element to it where folks have questions for any of the various groups? Will there be some sort of fixed site or fixed email address or something like that?
Well, from the Weather Service perspective, we're going to be creating a website that will be housed under the National Weather Service Phoenix page that will have kind of the daily messages, the themes, and then a large resources list where people can get more information. And certainly on the social media front, they can certainly interact with us. If we post something, they can ask a question of us to get more information. So it certainly is very interactive and something that they can partake in.
How did these groups come together, Ken?
It's a collaborative effort of a lot of agencies, and I'd also add in the City of Phoenix with their heat relief network. It's a very active group looking at ways to deal with taking care of the public out there.
Matt, education is so important, but how much else needs to be there? I guess we were just talking about with DPS, about distracted driving, and people need to know that it's out there. Are there a lot of people we feel like don't actually know what the message is, or they just don't acknowledge it? I guess that's one of the things that I wonder about, this concept that we can have the statistics, but a lot of people tend to say, well, that won't be me.
Well, one of the things that we try to drive home is being informed. So knowing when the weather is going to be hot, but also what are your resources? So one of the things that some people may not know about is that we have cooling centers available throughout the Valley. And these cooling centers are places to get free water and air conditioning and just be out of that hot environment.
And Jessica, I want to get some final thoughts from you on this, especially this idea that this first campaign seems to be focused on the Valley, which makes sense to those of us where it'll be extremely hot. Is this something that we hope is statewide, region-wide at some point?
Well, heat impacts all corners of the state. It might not be as hot in Tucson, but certainly out west in Yuma and along the Colorado River Valley, it certainly is an impact. So with this first initiative, with most of the partners being here in Phoenix, that's kind of where we're starting. But we certainly hope that it can grow and gain some more ground across the state so we can get more partners and more folks involved.
Jessica Nolte and Ken Waters of the National Weather Service, Matt Roach of the State Department of Health Services Climate and Health Program. Thanks to all of you. Appreciate
the
time.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. There's a documentary that looks into one of Phoenix's most famous rockers, Alice Cooper. The film is called Super Duper Alice Cooper. And joining me right now is Scott McFadgen. Scott, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Scott, tell us how this got started. I'm wondering, Alice Cooper's been famous for many years. How did this documentary come together? How easy or difficult was it to get access?
Well, we had made a movie on the band Rush called Rush Beyond the Lighted Stage, and we were at an awards ceremony in London, England, and Shep Gordon, Alice's manager, who had seen the Rush doc, approached us about doing a doc on Alice. We were pretty excited. He's a pretty influential character in pop culture and, you know, in rock music, so we got the green light and went ahead and did it.
How influential is he as a musician? Because people tend to get caught up in the act that he's had for so many years.
Yeah, I mean, especially some of that early stuff with the Alice Cooper Band. I mean, that was very influential on, early garage rock and punk rock, you know. I mean, you know, we talk about Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols auditioned for the band by singing I'm 18, on a jukebox. So he's definitely been influential on a lot of different types of music. And, yeah, and definitely the stage show is a big part of it, right? It's glam rock, punk rock, and glam metal in the 80s. So he's had, you know, and then you go forward to Marilyn Manson and Lady Gaga. I mean, so I think mostly the stage show has had the big influence, but definitely the music as well.
And he's had a really interesting life, and I suppose that can be said about a lot of rock and rollers, but the fact that he's made such a strong conversion into Christianity, when you got a chance to talk with him, you got a chance to look into his background, what made him make that change, and is he still able to look back on his days of really hardcore music fondly? Can he look back at the show and looking at it as more of like a Halloween show as opposed to something he believed, or is there another layer we should get to there?
You know, I mean, his grandfather was a pastor, and his dad was a pastor, and he grew up connected to the church, and I think that I don't think he ever lost that connection, as Vincent Furnier has always thought seen himself as having a very special relationship with God, and he talks about this in the documentary, and then, you know, and definitely he, with this Alice Cooper character, it almost, you know, it took over Vincent Furnier and almost killed him. And then, you know, as we get to in the documentary, he kind of returns to, you know, Phoenix, returns to his family, returns to church, and hasn't touched a drop of alcohol since. So, you know, it's a very redemptive story. I didn't set out to make a religious story, but there certainly is a bit of religion in there.
When you talked heart to heart with him, did he feel like when he was making those decisions, he was ultimately a rock and roller? He was ultimately misguided? Did he ever think he was a bad guy for doing those things?
Yeah, I think for him it's always been, you know, a creature from the Black Lagoon. It's very much a horror show. It's vaudeville. That's what he's been creating. I think more it's just in he let that character that he portrayed on stage, creep into his personal life. And I think that's where, at the end of the film, when we get to in 1986, he definitely made a very clear separation. You know, now when he's Vince Furnier, he's the golfer, he's your neighbor, he's a citizen of Phoenix, but he's, you know, when he's on stage, that's when he takes into the, you know, goes into the character.
Scott McFadgen is one of the makers of the documentary Super Duper Alice Cooper, about Valley resident Alice Cooper. Scott, thanks very much for the time.
Cheers, thank you.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. You might know Valley musician Roger Klein from his super catchy D-backs theme song, but Klein has been in local bands since the early 90s, and his current band, Roger Klein and the Peacemakers, just released a new album yesterday called The Independent. The band has something of a cult-like following, so for fans of the Peacemakers, it can seem like Klein has a pretty big stage persona. I talked to them about his new record and whether or not he has a certain persona for his fans.
It is basically free form. I don't want to have to live a life where I'm something different on the stage and off. So I'm very transparent and very open about how I live. In my lyrics, occasionally I do take liberties, and that's part of the art, but generally any anything hyperbolic or any representation in a song or a story song is part of me.
So where does the rock star come from? How do you find that balance?
Balance can be tough, but I've never really been, luckily, I guess I've never really been a big enough star to have to worry about it. I go to Safeway and I buy my you know, my Sunday wine and Brussels sprouts, and I say hello to whomever's there. I'm just a neighborhood poet who's got a guitar and a really good band, and humility is just part of my life.
What are some of your favorites? What got you into wanting to be a musician?
I remember exactly where I was when I first heard a song that emotionally really kind of freaked me out. I was living for a summertime as a kid, probably 4 or 5, at my grandparents' cattle ranch in Southeast Arizona, and they were playing an 8-track tape of the Sons of the Pioneers' greatest hits.
Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Cool Water came on, and Ghost Riders in the Sky came on. And actually, Cool Water was great to listen to. It's so much imagery. And then Ghost Riders came in, and it actually spooked me. And I went to find an adult to come back and listen to that tune with me. And I remember having that emotional resonance with that music. And then later on, my grandfather and my father turned me on to Willie Nelson and Marty Robbins and those guys, you know, storyteller dudes, and Johnny Cash. Fast forward to high school, when I traded my cowboy boots in for a skateboard and some Vans and started listening to punk, and then started to slowly discover at the moment, to my dismay, that those other really authentic country artists had a lot in common with punk rock. And that's probably where the synthesis or the confluence came from. And then from there, new wave started happening, and I started listening to all the broken hearts of Gordon Gano from the Violent Femmes, and the strange dark poetry of David Lowery from Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven, and I was hooked ever since. So I threw all those things into one big pot, mix in a little Bob Marley and some world beat, and that's where it all comes from. Oh, and mariachi music too, which is a whole different story.
So where does Arizona fit for you in terms of influence on your music?
Man, born and raised here, proudly so, even though I must admit when I was in high school, I wanted to leave it behind. I wanted to get out of this town, right? This big thing, Arizona. And I was just, oh no, it's only a stop on the interstate. Thank goodness I've come around, and I now view this place as a cultural confluence. We have so much amazing diversity and so many cultures that come together, and more so as people emigrate from the East Coast and from elsewhere to Phoenix. How does it figure? I've listened my whole life to Norteña music and mariachi music, and on this album, on The Independent, I pretty liberally use mariachi style trumpets in there because I just love what it does to tunes.
The Independent, the title track, it's an instrumental, first of all,
right?
Which
threw
me off.
On there,
I was thinking back to radio even like 30 years ago when I was a kid, and you could turn on a local radio station and you might actually hear
an instrumental.
Now you never would. What's the vibe behind actually allowing an instrumental on a CD these days?
Way back when I was listening to LPs, anything from the Police's early catalog, they would have instrumentals that would definitely inform the album as a whole, would help to fill in colors and, or even, I guess figuratively speaking, create negative space, right? Without lyrics, but still keep tone. Jim Dalton wrote, for the most part, that tune, and I heard it when we were working in Mexico on the last record. We recorded Unida Cantina, actually in Rocky Point, Mexico, and he was playing that, and I wished that I had lyrics for it at the time, and I didn't, and I didn't have time to write them. It usually takes me quite a while. He brought that back out in the studio, and I realized I don't want to muddy this up with lyrics. Would you mind if we all sort of took a stab at it and played it? Could we make this work? And he said it'd be an honor. And so we recorded it and then tried it on in different places as an intro, somewhere in the middle as an interlude, and then finally at the end, I think it really set sort of a closing credits feel to it, almost spaghetti western, the lone hero or anti-hero, depending on how you're feeling that day, off into the sunset on his tall, underfed horse, you know, or hers, her underfed horse. But that, it definitely sets a visual in my mind without having any words, and that's the impact of that music.
So it takes you a while to write lyrics. Writing lyrics, that's a real, it's kind of a tender, delicate thing, I would think, a process behind it, where you really want it to fit what's going with the music. How do you do that? How do you know when you've got it?
It's a crazy lab. I don't. It's just sometimes I do know, sometimes I don't. A lot of times I just let it go. And that's part of the creative process, is finally just stopping. Just get your hands off the machine, move on. There are times, the way it usually happens is I'll start with an idea and not know how to express it. It'll flesh itself out usually in a dream or in some moment where I'm not writing. And it just comes out. I'll be driving, you know, picking up the kids from Kung Fu or something, and boom, there it is. Hold on, right where we want them. And that's what I wanted to say. Then I'll try to follow that up, and usually I replace every line by the time the song is done. They begin as placeholders, and then I have to edit, and then get it all together.
How do you keep it from being corny?
I don't know. Sometimes it's context that will keep it from being corny. Sometimes it's context that makes it corny. If you look at my lyrics without the music, without that context, I get pretty sensitive, and I think that they don't carry near the weight, and sometimes I just go, oh no, you know, please don't ever let these be seen on a page without the music. Regarding corny, it's even, for me, it's a challenge as a writer not to become a parody of myself, because I don't want to be a tourist trap. I mean, I could stick with what works, songs about girls, Mexico, beer, and gunfights, right? Yeah. That's not all I want to use, though. The world is big and life is short.
So you're not like the Jimmy Buffett of Arizona, then?
I don't think so. I do get those comparisons, but I don't think so. And I don't think of that as a pejorative. I just think of it as an easy definition.
I ain't got the words for this. I've been playing for blood, but baby, all I really want is a kiss. I ain't got the words for this. I was building the bridge and realized I really love the abyss. I ain't got the words for this. When you say to obey, all I want to do is resist. No words for this feeling. I'm reeling from flow to ceiling. I'm careening. You're up to bat, boy. Bring us a hit while I take another swing and a miss. I ain't got the words for it.
First track on The Independent is Ain't Got the Words. And you know what struck me about this? Your voice sounded really raspy. Is there a story behind that?
Hammered, yeah. that song, regarding its writing, it was the first song I wrote at the beginning of this this sort of writing discipline, trying to come up with enough music to have a compendium and release an album. I found myself looking at my middle 40s and basically stuck. I had a pretty major episode of writer's block, which happens to me in some way every time I sit behind a guitar or try to write. But I was coming up with nothing day after day, and maybe even week after week. And finally, I started to write about the writer's block. And I started with Ain't Got the Words, and that's where it all fell into place. That was the first brick. Originally, I sang it in a different register, in the higher register, those first lines. And we recorded the song that way. And then PH, who's our drummer and produced this record, called me with an idea. He said, I think you need to sound a little bit more bedraggled, a little bit more desperate, a little bit more beat down, not so clean in the opening lines of this tune. And it just so happened that we had finished our set at JJ's Cantina, January Jam at JJ's down in Choya Bay. And when he called me, I was super raspy on the phone. I had lost my voice that weekend. And he said, you sound like you should come in right now. And I said, I can barely talk. And he said, no, it's perfect. Let's see what you can croak out. We did that, and it seemed to really work.
Roger Klein of the Peacemakers, the new CD is called The Independent. Very happy to have him with us. Roger, thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Valley rocker Roger Klein, he and the Peacemakers have a new album, The Independent. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help. And thank you for listening. To hear any of this program again or one of our previous programs, go online to kjzz.org later this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone and hear the program that way. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.